You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And volume 4 has arrived, Dr. Finn Pollard, and we have a terrific triumvirate of co-hosts on Past Prologue, the election special.
We do. We have Dr. Andrew Defty from the School of Politics.
Hello.
Dr. Ian Packer from History and Heritage.
Hello.
And Professor Philippa Hoskin, also from History and Heritage.
And as this is a pre-record, just ahead of our Thursday emergence into the wonderful world of radio, we have to acknowledge, obviously, the significant events taking place in Manchester, which might, of course, be echoed in some way, shape or form from comments on the programme today.
Yes, I thought we should just have that proviso. We had a whole list of things we thought we might talk about, but in fact, obviously, that issue may come in various places, and it seemed also to be something we should think about at the head as well. So we're going to start off by thinking about the sort of most immediately contemporary perspective with Andrew. And as I say, we obviously had a list of things we thought we might talk about, but it seemed to make sense, given the terrible events of last night, to start off with a little bit of reflection on what kind of effect an event like this can have on an election campaign, and also this fact that, of course, the campaign is now suspended, and what kind of impact that may have on where we go from here.
Sure. Well, terrorist attacks in the UK are mercifully rare, and they're particularly rare during election campaigns. Actually, back in 92, there was a bombing at the Baltic Exchange the day after the 1992 general election, which was clearly designed to send a message to the incoming Conservative government at that time, but not during the campaign. And of course, we had the murder of Joe Cox during the EU referendum, which was also clearly a terrorist incident. Of course, we don't know whether this attack was designed to have an impact on the election. We don't know enough about it yet. But I think the kind of closest parallel we can perhaps draw is the 2004 Madrid bombing, when 192 people were killed on trains in Madrid in a bombing carried out by Al-Qaeda. And in that case, the bombing was widely seen to have had an impact on that election. The government of Jose Aznar was defeated in the election, although actually, in retrospect, it's not clear whether he was defeated in because people objected to his response to the terrorist attack. The initial government response was to try and blame it on the Basque separatist group ETA, or whether it was in response more broadly to the Aznar government's foreign policy in Iraq. With regard to this particular attack, we don't know whether it's designed to influence the election, and it's perhaps hard to see how it's going to have an impact. It's hard to see any party benefiting in any way from what is going along. There's been some speculation that recent terrorist attacks in continental Europe, in France and Belgium in particular, have been designed to kind of stoke up political unrest and have perhaps given some weight to right-wing parties in continental Europe. But actually, it's hard to see any party in the UK benefiting from this kind of attack. It's also some time before the election. There'll be a suspension of campaigning, and I don't think any of the parties yet have said when they'll begin campaigning again. But of course, the other thing we know about general election campaigns is that they generate a great deal of the campaigns themselves generate sound and fury, but we actually know that most people tend to have made up their minds before the campaign starts.
So, moving away into perhaps more cheerful waters. We were originally thinking about starting off with this question of why do you think we are actually having a general election at this point, given, for example, that we were supposed to have a fixed-term Parliament Act that would prohibit this kind of thing? And can recent elections tell us anything about where we're going to end up on June the 9th.
Well, I think that why we're having it an interesting question. I mean, this is the shortest parliament for more than 40 years since 1974. We've got a fixed term parliament act, which is meant to lock governments in for 5 years. And actually, the government has quite a lot on its plate anyway at the minute. So it does seem rather strange to be going to the polls at this stage. It's very hard to see beyond this being an opportunity taken by the government to capitalise on the fact that the principal opposition party, the Labour Party, is doing so terribly badly in the polls and consistently badly in the polls at the minute. At the same time, I think it's also worth bearing in mind that Theresa May only recently became leader of the Conservative Party, leader of the government, and I do want... there's a natural inclination, perhaps, to seek a personal mandate. I suspect Theresa May might also be looking back at Gordon Brown in 2007, and Brown famously didn't take the opportunity to go to the country at that time, and I suspect went on to regret it. So the opportunity to do that now might be seeking to avoid that. And also the government has said that this is about strengthening their hand in terms of the Brexit negotiation. I find it a bit difficult to countenance that. We had a referendum in which the result was fairly conclusive. The government has claimed to want to have more power in order to drive the Brexit negotiations in Parliament, but actually they've had no problems in Parliament getting what they want. They got the Article 50 legislation through really quite easily. The problem is really more in the country than it is in Parliament. So,
do you think the fact that they've, in a sense, seem to have swatted the Fixed Term Parliament Act's provisions aside with ease means that it really is a dead letter on the statute book now, that the idea that it will, you know, that it will be applied in any way going forward is really, you know, we're back to the sort of previous situation where prime ministers had a great deal of freedom about when they would call elections?
I think it almost certainly will mean that if the Conservatives win the election, because it's in their manifesto that they will repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. Actually, one of the things they haven't said is how they're going to repeal it or what they're going to replace it with. So it's not simply a case of repealing the Act. If you repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, you have a Parliament that lasts in perpetuity. You have to replace it with something else, hopefully. Unless that's the intent.
I imagine some MPs might be quite happy with that state of affairs.
Absolutely.
Do you think that having does a snap election like this pose particular challenges for the sort of the smooth running of government, for individual MPs, for the way Parliament operates?
I think it poses challenges for the smooth running of government, and I think it also poses significant challenges for political parties. So one of the consequences of having a snap election is that legislation has been rushed through, select committee inquiries have been either rushed through or curtailed. That 24 bills have passed since the last, in this parliamentary session, 24 bills have passed, 13 of those were passed on the final day of the parliamentary session. 44 select committee inquiry reports were published between the announcement of an election and the dissolution of Parliament, and 100 inquiries were curtailed, simply stopped. So actually there's questions about what the snap election has done to the scrutiny function of government, and actually this is taking place at a time when the government has been under, and rightly so, significant scrutiny with regard to the pursuit of the Brexit negotiations. With regard to the parties, campaigners, party members out there must feel like they've been campaigning continuously for about the last 3 or 4 years. And it's a significant stretch. It's a stretch on their resources. It's a stretch on the funds that the parties have. So I think there are significant difficulties for them then. And it's a stretch for them to go out there and persuade people to come out and vote. I think one of the real tests in this election might be turnout. We've had a kind of gradually rising turnout I mean, there's been a downward trend since the 90s, but we've had it gradually rising since 2001. I think it'll be unfortunate and disappointing, but I suspect the turnout may be fairly low this term time around.
Do you think primarily from fatigue or from disillusion, or is it difficult to tell what the...
It's hard to put motivation down to individual votes, but yes, voter fatigue. I mean, why are we being asked to vote again? We've had to vote in a general election. We voted in an EU referendum. We were out last month voting in local council elections. Politics is my thing, but even I find this somewhat wearing, you know.
Why would anyone?
That was Arcadia with Election Day just fading out there. And we're going to move sort of further back in history now, I think, in thinking about whether there are historical parallels to the present circumstances. We already touched a bit on examples such as the possible links between May's desire for a mandate and Gordon Brown's decision not to have an early election. And we had a brief reference to the circumstances in October, February and October 74. But I'd like to turn to Dr. Ian Packer now and ask whether you think there are other historical parallels between the circumstances in which this election has been called and previous elections.
Well, it's not been that uncommon to have a situation whereby one general election has been followed quite shortly afterwards by another one. And those have happened for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes party leaders have changed their minds about a major policy and have sought a new mandate from the electorate to strengthen their hand in carrying it out. You could think of William Gladstone over the policy of Home Rule, devolved government for Ireland in 1886, or the Conservatives in 1923 when they wanted to abandon free trade and introduce kind of protectionism. In both cases, an election occurred, you know, very shortly after, less than a year after the previous election. And then you've had situations where minority governments have collapsed. They've been unable to continue in Parliament. So the first Labour government in 1924 only lasted 9 months because it didn't have a majority in Parliament. And then actually between 1922 and 1924, you had three elections in 3 years for those reasons. But the most common reason for having an election shortly after another general election has been a government seeking to improve its majority if it has a small majority, or if it's a minority government seeking to gain a majority. So, I mean, in October 74, the Labour government didn't have a majority, so it went to the country after the February 74 election in order to try and obtain one. 1966, Harold Wilson looked to improve his majority after the 1964 general election. And in 1951, the Labour government elected in 1950 again had a very small majority, and they were looking to increase that majority. So that's been the most common, the common reason in recent years.
And is there any sort of consistency in the modelling in terms of their success in improving their majorities in those circumstances, or is it very dependent on the particular circumstances of each election?
Yeah, it's very dependent. I mean, Harold Wilson was the past master of this because he successfully did it twice. From February 74, a minority Labour government, he was able to win a small majority in October 1974. 1966, he was able to win quite a substantial majority after the very narrow majority won in 64. But then the Labour government that had been re-elected in 1950 was actually defeated in 1951. Despite the fact it actually got more votes than the Conservatives, it still lost the general election. And certainly, if one looked further back in history, I mean, you have both positive and negative examples too. So I think it would be very hard to say whether a government definitely is going to benefit or not from calling a general election shortly after another one.
I want to come back for a moment to this, the parallels with elections being fought on particular issues.
Right.
And the obviously you were mentioning Gladstone and Home Rule and the Tories later on abandoning free trade. Mm. When, obviously, they called the election, and that was very much the issue that was uppermost in calling the election. Was it the case in those instances that then, you know, through the election campaign, that issue stayed the focus of the election? Or did you have a sort of drift into other issues?
I very much, in 1886 over Home Rule and in 1923 over free trade against protection, those were, I think, the key issues in the election, and they were both incredibly controversial issues. And certainly in terms of Home Rule, I mean, one can see that as a constitutional issue in the same way that Brexit is at least partly a constitutional issue too. And over free trade and protection, it was about abandoning a very long-standing policy which had been historically very closely associated with Britain's economic success, and which was seen, I think, in some ways as almost equivalent to a major kind of constitutional change. So I think if the issue is big enough, then it won't go away. That doesn't necessarily imply, of course, that Brexit is going to crowd out every issue in this election. I think there might be some indications already that other issues have started to come to the fore as well. And that might well be because the electorate feel they've already decided about Brexit and they don't feel the need to debate it all over again in this general election. They prefer to talk about social care or other matters.
No, I mean, I think that's why I think it's one of the interesting phenomenon of the election that it, although it ostensibly called on Brexit, that has not, it seems to me, been the central focus of the discussion.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's really quite surprising that Brexit has featured so little in the campaign at all. In a sense, they don't want to talk about it, none of the parties. But the other thing is, there's a broad political consensus. The Liberal Democrats are perhaps outside of that, but they're chasing different votes. But there's a broad political consensus on Brexit. Nobody's disputing what the outcome of the referendum was. And, you know, there's some debate about whether there should be a second referendum. But this is not really an election that's being based on whether Britain should leave the European Union or not. Everyone seems to accept that ultimately will be the end point. So, in a sense, it's not a Brexit election at all.
Which would seem, in a sense, actually to make an interesting contrast with the Home Rule or the free trade elections, where, in fact, the issue was still very much a live issue in the context of those campaigns.
And you could make another comparison as well with the election in December 1910, which was only 9 or 10 months after the election in February 1910, and that was an election specifically about the powers of the House of Lords. And if you look at all the campaign material from that general election, that was the key live issue about should the powers of the House of Lords be curtailed or not, and if they should be, in what way. Whereas I think Andrew's absolutely right to say that I think as far as most of the electorate are concerned, and certainly the two major political parties are concerned, we're not actually debating about whether Brexit should happen or not in this election. So I think it's not surprising that many members of the electorate want to talk about other things.
The other issue that sort of arises from that is, how successful were those earlier elections at resolving those issues? Was the issue of free trade or the issue of Home Rule resolved by the result of those elections? Or did it in fact... it's clear, I think, that... I think you're right that in this election the assumption of the broad majority of the electorate is that Brexit is already agreed, and what might happen afterwards may upend that a little bit. But I wonder what the situation was in those earlier cases.
Well, of course, no parliament can bind its successor. So an election can only decide things until there's another election. And certainly 1886 decided that there wouldn't be Home Rule until there was another general election when the issue could be debated again. Because what happened in 1886 is it became clear that one of the major parties of state, the Liberal Party, was committed to the idea of devolution of powers to an Irish Parliament. And the issue did not go away. It was just settled that for the Parliament elected in 1886, there would not be Home Rule. Similarly with free trade and protection in 1923, the idea of protection was decisively defeated, but because one of the major parties, the Conservative Party, remained committed to the idea of abandoning free trade, it didn't go away. And indeed, after 1931, Britain moved to a protectionist system after a Conservative-dominated coalition won a landslide election. So an election can decide something for the parliament that is elected at that election, but it can't decide something for the longer term as long as one of the major parties remains committed to that policy.
Do you get any parallels to this phenomenon at the moment where it seems to me there's a sort of argument going on that the issue is on Brexit is very much settled and there isn't a sort of space to have another consideration about it? When they were debating Home Rule or free trade, were they also saying after that election, right, you've now, the voters have now said what the position is on these things and it will not be reopened further? Or was the dynamic different? I mean, I imagine the fact that we've had a referendum would make for a different dynamic to the position then.
I think it does. And the major kind of difference in the kind of examples we've been talking about is that one of the major parties of state said, okay, in this time the electorate have rejected this policy, but we haven't stopped believing in it, and we will put the arguments to the electorate again in the future, and we will see if they've changed their mind. And if you believe in a kind of a parliamentary system whereby the electorate is always meant to be open to kind of rational argument, it's not unreasonable to say that, okay, if we make our arguments more persistently and persuasively, we will be able to persuade people to change their minds. And in the future, we may well get a different result. We've never had, I don't think, Andrew, any kind of situation like this is in the past, where we've actually had a national referendum which has decided something, and then we're supposed to have another general election to talk about it again.
No, it's slightly odd. On the other hand, we have previously had a referendum on our membership of the European Union, and I am, I'm somewhat sceptical as to whether this will draw a line under that. When I said that I think that the public have broadly accepted the results of this referendum, I think that's the case, but that doesn't mean that the public have all suddenly jumped behind leaving the European. I think there's a broad kind of respect for the outcome, but actually I don't for a minute think that this means that that's the end of the debate about Britain's relationship with Europe or whether Britain should be in and out. And actually, if you look at the polling data since the referendum, there's been very little shift on either side. So the public remains fundamentally divided on this question about whether Britain should remain in or stay out. Now, they're less divided on the question of whether we should respect the results of the referendum, but actually, with regard to the fundamental issue, there doesn't appear to be there appears to be very little shift on that at all.
I'm yanking doodle dandy in a gold Rolls Royce. This is Siren FM.
The Rock Train, leaving the station every other Thursday, 8 till 10, bringing you the best local and international bands from the world of rock and metal. The Rock Train. No tracks are too heavy.
Just before the trail there, you heard Alice Cooper in Elected. And we're going to turn now to go rather further back in time to the medieval period. And I thought I'd start by asking you, Philippa, can you say something about the medieval origins of Parliament? And could you be elected to it? Are there any sort of, parallels to the present position?
Well, I suppose the answer to can you be elected to Parliament is no and yes, depending on what period you're talking about. Parliaments are summoned. They're summoned by the king. Until the late 13th century, he can summon them when he wants, and if he doesn't want one for years, he doesn't have to do so. But he has to summon Parliament if he wants a mandate. He has to summon it if he wants to do something like, for example, raise a tax, which isn't something he'd normally do. So as he increasingly wants to raise taxes, increasingly he has to summon his parliaments. Now, until the mid-13th century, a parliament is considered representative. That is, that the people who come to it represent the people. But it's not exactly elected. It's not very broadly made up. It's the barons, the chief landowners of the country, that's the secular landowners, and the bishops as the ecclesiastical landowners. But then from the mid-13th century, people start to think about other parts of the country. People start to be chosen from the burgesses and from the counties, the knights, slightly lesser landowners, not exactly what you'd call the people. And they are elected. They are elected originally probably just by their peers, people of their own status. By 1430, you can be elected by anyone who has more than 40 shillings worth of land. So there's an extent to which, yes, certain sorts of people are elected, but it's not an elected body. It is a representative body.
And how do the elections work? Is this are they sort of shouting out names in the marketplace or... I'm tempted to say dropping pebbles into buckets, but I'm sure this is not accurate.
We're not entirely sure. But what probably happened was that we know people gathered together to elect, probably 100 of them maybe, maximum, maybe 200 if you're in a particularly large, say, city. And a consensus arrived about who you were going to send to Parliament. It seems to have been uncommon for people to be sent regularly. You know, re-election, so to speak, did not happen a lot.
And do you get sort of tension about who is who qualifies under this 40 shilling rule, or do we have any evidence of sort of controversy about that, or does it seem to have been broadly accepted who was in that group and who wasn't?
It seems to have been broadly accepted, probably because if you agreed to be in the 40 shilling rule, so to speak, to have 40 shillings worth of property, you would be taxed as though you had 40 shillings worth of property as well, and taxation was coming very soon after Parliament, so you had to balance it. But yeah, that seems to have been generally accepted.
And was it the case that once the king had called these parliaments in the hope of getting whatever policy he wanted sort of endorsed or whatever taxation he wanted sort of agreed upon, did they usually do what he wanted? Was he able to move his agenda forward? Or at what point do you start sort of getting, do you start seeing in the medieval period sort of tensions between kings and the beginnings of these parliaments, or does that come later?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Of course, if the king wants something from you, it's a good chance for you to ask for something from the king. And people did, and sometimes parliaments ended without the king getting what he wanted because he wouldn't move. From the 13th century, late 13th century on as well, there are increasingly another way that you can pursue things with the king, and they're called petitions. Individuals could send petitions to Parliament about their very individual concerns. Someone's taken my piece of land, I've not been given, in one case, my harp back after a battle. But at the same time, communities could make complaints, and the communities made complaints through the knights and the representatives of the town, who were the commons. They were the common complaints. So local complaints are going to the king as well. If he doesn't deal with those, then the commons won't give him what he wants.
Do we know if they got the harp back?
Alas, we don't.
I wanted to also, you were mentioning that there are sort of other ways in which sort of election processes are going on, and this is in relation to bishops and sort of the religious hierarchy, and I wonder if we might talk a bit about that for a few moments.
Yeah, it's clear that medieval Europe did understand election. You could elect a bishop is a good example. So the members of the cathedral clergy would be allowed in theory to elect their bishop, and they fought quite hard, certainly in England in the 13th century, to maintain that position. The king wanted very often to interfere in that. Bishop's an important man. He can use him for negotiations. And there are occasions where the king basically turns up at a cathedral and just sits in the room next door with his knight saying, "Don't worry, Russ, we're just sharpening our swords. You elect whoever you want. Don't think about this person." But there was a fight to get that election to be free. They managed to get King John to give them a charter, for example, saying that churches should have free elections. And this has followed on from very early elections of bishops, which were by acclamation by the people. So it has been a much broader election, say, in the 7th century, that has become a sort of narrower group.
Do you get then electioneering going on in the church? I'm sort of imagining, I don't know, bishops going round the clergy and promising them, I don't know, particular offices in the new cathedral administration or parishes with particularly lucrative incomes?
Well, there is a certain amount of that. It's not clear that bishops or prospective bishops were promising things. But on the other hand, if a bishop who supported you, who was your lord, so to speak, got in, then yes, as a clergyman, you were more likely to get a good position. So, yeah, you did want to support your person. What we can see is examples of people trying to maintain positions that can mean they can call foul on elections. So if you were going to choose to stand for election as a bishop, or you thought you stood a chance of being proposed, you made sure, for example, that if you were illegitimate, the Pope had already approved you to be a bishop. Because if he hadn't, someone, one of the opposing candidates would have found that out. They'd wait till you were just about elected and they'd say, "Oh, sorry, can't be a bishop."
And do you get any pushback to this? Because this, obviously, my sense is, as time goes on, you're moving more towards the kind of order we would think of as more natural, where there's less dominance by the king and more power moving to Parliament and more power moving to a sort of, I suppose, a more elected system. Mm. Is there anyone trying to turn the clock back and say, really, it'd be much better if we went back to the days of, a more autocratic system where we didn't have these elections, we didn't have sort of too much attention to what the people, or at least the sort of elite, might want?
Not in church elections, no. You don't see much pushback against that, because it's in the interest of the people who are electing always to try and maintain their power. It's the balance of power. You do occasionally see kings who clearly have a hankering for not having to have the Knights of the Shire in anymore, and think how good it would be if they could get rid of these petitions, and they do manage to push them away a bit, maybe towards the end of the 15th century. But the Black Death makes that very hard for them. Big fall in the workforce, very hard for everybody to maintain position. People further down social scale are getting more power. Girls, we run this mother.
Check, come at the neck, disrespect.
Beyonce with Who Runs the World Girls, which could possibly become the anthem for Theresa May, maybe if she is successful on June the 8th, or perhaps not. She might like something a bit more staid, I don't know. we were talking at the end there about the degree to which in the medieval period you were starting to get a widening of participation in these processes. And I wonder whether other members of the panel feel that that process of sort of widening of perhaps greater democratisation has continued down to the present day. Can we say that we've got a substantially more democratic system now, or is it perhaps more murky than we might like to think?
Well, interesting, while Philip was talking, I was thinking we actually still have a medieval parliament in some respects. It looks like that day. I mean, it's not, but it is. And also, actually, although we're going to the polls in June, we're only electing one chamber of a bicameral legislature, and we're actually only electing the smallest chamber. There are many more people sitting in the House of Lords, and they're appointed, and including 26 Church of England bishops who owe their position to the fact that they're bishops in the established church. So it does make me wonder whether we've really moved on a great deal from that. From that period, there are actually many hangovers remaining.
Another very obvious one, of course, is we still have a first-past-the-post electoral system whereby we have MPs representing specific local constituencies, and the members of Parliament we elect are the people who come first in whatever town or county constituency it is that they're standing for. And that means, of course, that system produces some rather complicated results, because most people, when they go to the polls now, are not electing an individual, they're voting for a party. So the outcome in terms of the number of seats that parties have in Parliament is only approximately related to the total number of votes they've got across the country. And of course that's still derived ultimately from our medieval system of electing kind of local representatives.
And first past the post is looking increasingly anomalous. We use it for Westminster elections, but we barely use it for any other elections across the UK. They don't use it for the Scottish Parliament or the Welsh Assembly or the Northern Ireland Assembly. We don't use it for European Parliament elections. Actually, single member constituencies are relatively rare in local government too. So actually it's Westminster that looks like the oddity in all of this.
Though I think there's a suggestion, isn't there, from the Tory manifesto that they might push back a little on that in London, and go back to first past the post for the London constituent for the London Assembly rather than the I forget exactly what system it is that's in use.
Yes.
I was just wondering on that, Philippa, is there any degree to which sort of party groupings are coming in medieval times? Do we have the sort of king trying to build up a sort of king's party?
Well, I suppose you would see the Lords almost as the king's party. The Lords who are his natural advisers is the statement that we use, the people he would always have called upon. And it's what increasingly had come to be the commons, the common people, the knights, who are most likely to be objecting. So you've got a sort of a county party, if you like, appearing. But again, it's still not very large. I mean, the House of Lords, so to speak, or the Lords, is a much larger group than the representatives of the county and the towns. There are only two representatives from major cities, and a lot of cities didn't count. I think Lincoln did at some places, times Norwich didn't. And there are only four representatives for each county. So it's not large numbers.
I was also thinking in terms of this question of whether it's becoming more equal, that another factor it might be the debate about the degree to which prime ministerial power is increasing, and whether and obviously only one constituency in a sense gets to vote for the Prime Minister, but in practice, especially as we seem to have moved increasingly perhaps to a more presidential style of campaigning, it might be an argument that we've kind of replaced, I mean, put it in very crude terms, replaced the situation where the king was a sort of dominant figure in the electoral and political process with a prime minister sort of acquiring some of those functions and power.
I think you can certainly say that. I mean, you can look at the you talk about the king bestowing honours. It's now the prime minister that has that power of patronage, and that's the most significant power that a prime minister wields in order to deliver honours, but also to make and break political careers. So I certainly think there are parallels there too.
Mm. One other thing I just wanted to pick up on before we move in another direction. I was thinking about, continuing to think about this amusing story about the person petitioning for the harp, and the degree to which local factors play or don't play a role within bigger general elections. And I wonder whether, to what extent do you think that that's still the case, that particular local issues can be a bigger factor than the sort of broader national question in an election, or has that become less so as we've moved into a more sort of, I don't know, sort of globalised world, a world in which presumably people are more plugged in now to national campaigns than might have been the case even, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
I think what might be interesting about this election, it's clearly the case that people are plugged into national campaigns, and actually this election, more than recent ones, has been focused on leadership. Corbyn in particular, but Theresa May as well. But actually what might work against that is if you have an incumbent Member of Parliament who's particularly well known in the constituency, and then it's not necessarily being fought on local issues, it might be being fought on personality, but fought on personality on a local level. And we've certainly seen Labour candidates going into this election trying to make it about them and not really about Corbyn, because he is languishing so lowly in the polls.
And of course, you have to remember now that we do actually have, now that we have devolved government, we actually have a number of different election campaigns going. The election in Scotland is about not really so much Brexit, but about independence. You know, Northern Ireland, of course, has an entirely different set of concerns about whether the union between Northern Ireland and the UK should be preserved. And indeed, even the Welsh political system is rather different in terms of the relative strengths of the political parties and the participation of Plaid Cymru. So you could actually say that we have an overall UK campaign going on, and we have four national campaigns going on as well as all the kind of local variations.
Would you say that's a change that's really come in since the devolution to particularly obviously Scotland and Wales, or are there previous instances of that kind of phenomena, say, earlier in the century?
Well, I mean, Andrew would know more than me, but it used to be said there was the iron law of the national swing, wasn't there?
Yes.
There really weren't local variations.
I mean, one of the noticeable things about general elections in recent years has been the fragmenting of the vote. So actually, for most of the post-war period into the 90s, more than 90% of the vote went to either the Conservatives or the Labour Party, and that's simply not the case. 67% of voters in 2015 voted either Conservative or Labour. So there's a large proportion of people voting for another party. Actually, in 2015, one in five voters voted for a party that wasn't Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat or SNP. So actually, we have an electoral system that's meant to encourage us to vote for one of two main parties. Mm-hmm. And actually, we're not following the rules, actually. People are going out there and voting for all kinds of different parties. So there has been a broad fragmenting of the vote since the 1990s, and it appears to be ongoing. It's going to be...
Vinegar into wine, and I think we must have died.
That was The Elected, Los Angeles-based band with See the Light. I should say we will not propose to tell you, the listener, what the light is in this election. So we've got time for just one more question. And it seemed appropriate, given the given that we're broadcasting from a university and we're based in a university town, to think a little bit about the what the role of young people might be in this election. There's obviously been ongoing debate about whether the voting age should come down to 16, and perhaps whether the position of young people in politics is different now from, I imagine, going back to Philippa's period, they had very little say at all in what their elders and betters were deciding. Who would like to jump in?
Well, I mean, young people have a significant voice. The simple fact is they're not using it. So the 18 to 24 age group are about half as likely to vote as the over 65s, and consequently, the parties aren't really interested in them. Actually, I think this time around, Labour are particularly interested in them because the 18 to 24 age group are the only group where Corbyn appears to have majority support. But it's a tough call to get a group of people who historically haven't voted to turn out and vote. They might be particularly significant in a constituency like Lincoln. The sitting MP has a majority of about 1,400, and they're about 13,000 students at the University of Lincoln. Most of them live within the constituency. If they turned out and voted, they wouldn't even have to vote. You know, the majority of them wouldn't have to vote in order to make a significant difference to the outcome.
I think certainly, I mean historically, the voting age has gradually descended. I mean, if you look at the period before 1918, we had what was called a householder franchise, where normally most voters were at least in their kind of mid-late 20s. And then in 1918, it came down to 21. And then it standardised at 21. And then, of course, 1969, I think I'm right, then it was moved down to 18. And in the Scottish referendum, of course, it came down to 16. And I think it's a tremendous irony, Andrew's pointing out there, that the continual kind of lowering of the voting age doesn't actually seem to have inspired more young people to actually go out and vote.
Actually, there are parts of the medieval period where 16-year-old could have voted, because a 16-year-old could obtain their property. They could run the property for themselves. So if they had the money, if they had the property, they would have been the person to vote. Because majority of them would never have had any voice at any age.
I'm having visions of people bumping off their parents in order to have a say in the next election. I think we're out of time for this edition, but that final thought about young people or young people not exercising their democratic power is an important reminder from us to you to, whatever you do on June the 8th, make sure you go out and exercise your vote in this election. I'd like to thank, as ever, the three panellists we've had with us today, Andrew Defty, Ian Packer and Philippa Hoskin. I'd also like to thank my colleague Alex Stefchuk from the School of English and Journalism for keeping us technically on the road, as always. And I'm Finn Pollard, and Past Prologue will be back, as ever, in about a month's time. Thank you.